This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk with Jim Lafferty on ISIS and the anti-war movement.
Jim was one of the national leaders of the movement against the war in Vietnam years ago. He's kept at it up till to date. It's worth listening to what he has to say.
We'll take a look at the life of Thomas Sankara, an African revolutionary.
Sankara, who was assassinated in 1987, was known as the African Che. Listen and find out why.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the A.J. Musty Memorial Institute.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Michael Smith, you just returned from a wonderful visit to Cuba. Why were you there? What happened?
Well, this was the culmination of an 18-year project that was initiated by Michael Ratner when he asked for and obtained two huge boxes of documents from the American government under a Freedom of Information Act request. He asked for their documents on Che Guevara. Michael was interested in trying to figure out the true story of what happened to Che in Bolivia. So I remember the day we were walking down the street in the village, and Michael said to me, I just got these two huge boxes of documents from the CIA and the White House and the Department of Defense and the State Department, and I want to show them to you. What should we do with them? So we went over to Michael's house, and sure enough, you know, there are these two huge boxes. And I had, at the time, been representing Ocean Press, which is an Australian publishing house, and because they're Australian, they can do commerce with Cuba. And they published a lot of stuff by Cubans and in Cuba. And I thought, well, maybe they'd be interested in these documents. So I emailed them, and they wrote back, and they said, we are very interested. We're stopping our catalog press. We want to hear about it, and we'll get it out immediately. Tell us what's in it so we can put it in the catalog. So Michael and I and my wife, Debbie, went through these two boxes, and we selected all the relevant documents about the FBI had a lot of other organizations' documents. So we called the book Che Guevara and the FBI, the American Secret Police Dossier on the Latin American Revolutionary. And we published the book. This is back in 1997.
That had such great comments in it by the FBI, as he's fairly smart for a Latino. Things like this showing the incredible bias of country's Secret Service.
You reprinted many of the documents that
you
got.
Yeah, we reprinted them. It's fascinating. You know, it's kind of scary to look at them. But a lot of them are all blocked out and stuff. But people were very interested in seeing the internal correspondence with these secret police agencies.
It tells what Che read when he was in the tent, how he read to people in the Sierra Maestra, whatever. It went on and on.
Yeah, it was interesting.
And did the Cubans like the book?
Yeah, in fact, we went down there, had a press conference, and they distributed the book. It was available at actually every hotel and gas station in Cuba back in 97. Well, anyway, let me bring the story up to date, because 10 years later, in 2007, without Michael making a further request, out of the blue, they shipped another big box to him. And this time, the documents were even more interesting. And in the intervening years, there'd been all this scholarship done on Che. But we were able, between the new scholarship and the new documents, to put out a book called
Who Killed Che is the name of the book.
And so, it has a great photo cover on here. Right, Che's lying down, it looks like on a gurney, and there's a man next to him with his face blacked out.
You know that
man anyway,
is?
The man
is, who is that?
That's Gustavo Villaldo. The book came out in America, published by Either Or, which is
Either
a wonderful
or.
Publishing house. And we had a big party at the Cuban mission. About 400 people came to it. And the Ricardo Alarcón, the head of the Cuban National Assembly, spoke over the phone. And we launched the book in English. Well, the reason I was in Cuba, to answer your question, is the Cubans were given the book as an act of solidarity by Or Books. Our friends Colin Robinson and John Oakes gave the Cubans the foreign rights to the book, didn't charge them, and the Cubans translated it and published it and launched it at the 24th International Havana Book Fair on February 13th. So they asked me and Michael to come down and speak. And I indeed spoke about the book at the law school 2 weeks ago Friday. And it was big news around Cuba. I was on Cuba national television, national radio. I got to say that the book is dedicated to our friend Lynn Wineglass, who was the attorney for the Cuban Five. The Cuban Five had just been released back in December. And at the opening of the International Book Fair, both Antonio and Gerardo were there. Mm-hmm. And that was really like the high point for me, I think, of getting to meet them.
That's amazing. Now, people should understand. Amazing. Gerardo was freed as part of this recent
exchange.
Or whatever they call it. But he had been given two life sentences plus 15 years.
Yeah.
And Michael, you should describe him because he sounds like he was amazing.
How
when you
was
met him.
He?
They truly are heroes.
Yeah.
For one thing, they're both extremely handsome and very tall, and they stand straight up, and they're very kind and articulate. I mean, they had 15 years in prison to practice English. So Debbie and I were introduced to them. We told them that we were actually friends with Lynn Wineglass. They said, you know, he was our lawyer, but he was also our friend.
Yes.
They talked about their relationship with Lynn. It was really wonderful. I just want to conclude with this. The point I made in my talk was that we know who killed Che.
The CIA.
The CIA. And we know who did it. And Michael makes the point in the book that it's not just the people who pulled the trigger, but the people who allowed it to happen, the people that acquiesced to it, the people who covered up.
Yep.
They're all guilty of a war crime.
Conspiracy.
And we know Gustavo Villaldo and Felix Rodriguez both live on our taxpayers' retirement funds in Miami. There's no statute of limitations on murder. We know who did it. They're there. And if justice were ever to prevail, it would be those two men and the people that worked with them that assassinated Che Guevara.
Well, thank you both for making the revelations of this book so widely available.
And thank you, Michael, again. It's called Who Killed Che? And it's now out in Cuba, and it's also out in Argentina. The one little point about Cuba, which is interesting, is that books are sold for very cheap in Cuba. And at this book fair, something like 5 million books are sold.
No.
It goes to 14 cities around Cuba. And
do you know how many they printed of yours?
Yeah. They printed
tens of thousands.
But they ran out right away.
No.
And they had to do a second printing. And we saw all these families from Havana, tens of thousands of people come up to the park to the book fair, walking around carrying books under their arms. Our book in Spanish in Cuba sells for 50 cents.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
That's
it's really fantastic.
You're going to be household names in Cuba.
Yeah, Michael and I are in Cuba and Argentina, but not in America.
So I got a note the other day from my friend Wolfgang Kolick, who's in Argentina. He's there for a month working on the trials, the book. He heads the European Center for Constitutional and Human Rights in Berlin. And he sends me a picture of Michael Smith's and my Che book in Spanish in an Argentinian bookstore. And next to it is a book by someone named Rodolfo Walsh. Rodolfo Walsh is extremely famous. He was killed in the 80s. He was a revolutionary, a journalist, and has written a number of books that were very famous. And was killed. And he says, Michael, he says to me, what an honor that your and Michael Smith's book is next to the book of Rodolfo Walsh. So not missing a beat, of course, I wrote him back. Wait a second. Don't you mean it's an honor for Rodolfo Walsh to be next to Michael Smith's in my book? Anyway, on that note, Michael, thanks for doing all the book tour in Argentina and in Cuba.
Michael, the journal Socialism and Democracy is presenting its special issue on mass incarceration in New York on Friday, March 20th. It's called Nothing to Lose But Our Chains, Black Resistance and the Roots of Mass Incarceration. The volume, as you know, was edited by Mumia Abu-Jamal and our friend and colleague Johanna Fernandez. The event will be held at the Malcolm X and Dr. Betty Shabazz Memorial and Educational Center. That's at 3940 Broadway at 165th Street. There's a reception and journal signing from 6 to 7 p.m., and then a panel discussion will begin promptly at 7. Speakers on the panel will be Sekou Odinga, recently released Political Prisoner, Asheron's Besporn from Black Youth Project 100, our friend and colleague Laura Whitehorn, a former political prisoner, Niall Fort, who we recently had on the show, Newark-based youth organizer and writer, and Dikwi Kioni Sadiki, educator and activist and also a friend and colleague. This is an intergenerational discussion between former political prisoners and Black Lives Matter activists. Please spread the word far and wide. It promises to be a wonderful event. Michael, you'll be speaking at New York University Law School this week?
Yes, I'm speaking at the NYU Law School on this Thursday, March 12th, 6 o'clock, on a panel discussion on Cuba and the new situation with regard to America and Cuba. The panel is me and Sandy Levinson from the Center for Cuban Studies, Michael Krinsky, who's the attorney for the Cuban government, and Joan Gibbs from the National Conference of Black Lawyers. From 6 to 9, it's free. NYU Law School, south side of Washington Square Park. Be good to see you there. Come up and introduce yourself.
Sounds like a great event, Michael.
Last June, the United States sent more military soldiers to Iraq and carried out airstrikes to stop the advance of the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, known as ISIS. Last week, Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu told an enthusiastic American Congress that Iraq, not ISIS, is the main enemy. If this is so, should the United States be involved in the Middle East at all? Our own Michael Ratner reported on how the U.S. could be given leave to make war everywhere if President Obama's request for the authorization of military force is granted by a U.S. Congress. What are the demands of the U.S. peace movement? We speak today with Attorney Jim Lafferty, the executive director of the National Lawyers Guild in Los Angeles and a leader in the American anti-war movement.
Jim Lafferty, it's always a pleasure to welcome you to Law and Disorder.
Well, it's always a pleasure to be with you folks, really.
Now, there's so many things we can talk to you about, but we'd like to focus a bit on ISIS and ask you, what gave rise to the creation of ISIS?
Yeah, well, that, of course, is important, I think, for the people of this country to understand as they hopefully will debate and think about what Obama wants to do next, which is sort of double down on a failed policy. It was U.S. military strategy in the Middle East to begin with, and past U.S. military action in that part of the world, especially in Iraq, that provided the primary catalyst for the growth of ISIS. I mean, we destroyed the secular governments in Iraq and Libya, and that created the political space for ISIS and other right-wing forces to grow. I mean, when you have years of sanctions and war in Iraq, you fragment the country along ethnic and sectarian lines, and countries in that part of the world often have tribal divisions to begin with. And we consciously reorganized the political life in Iraq. Oh, we said a Shiite would be prime minister, a Kurd would be president, a Sunni would be speaker of the National Assembly. And then starting in 2003, 2004, in an effort to prevent the reemergence of a united Iraq, a resistance to our occupation, we started funding militias whose identities were anchored in religion or ethnicity. We bombed populated areas in Iraq, and thereby marginalizing the central government. The old Iraq wasn't there anymore. ISIS filled the governing vacuum, took advantage of these ethnic divisions, angered at the U.S., and steadily gained strength thereafter. The people were angry at the U.S. If you think about it, we spent the last 40, 50 years destroying leftist and secular anti-imperialist movements all over that region of the world and governments that constituted any kind of leadership of anti-colonial and anti-imperialist movements. So I don't think the U.S. should now be surprised that loathsome organizations like ISIS have risen to fill that void.
What about President Obama, in advance of any congressional authorization for the use of military force, which is what he's going to ask for? But aren't they already waging the very war that he's now talking about authorizations for?
Yeah, I mean, he's looking for political cover. He's tired of being called a wimp by the Congress, so he asks them to have some backbone and support his failed policy. There are already thousands of more troops on the ground. 2 weeks ago, the Pentagon announced it's sending another 4,000 U.S. troops with very heavy weaponry to Kuwait. the U.S. Army has already set up a quote-unquote division headquarters in Iraq, a new division headquarters in Iraq. Well, a division consists of 20,000 troops. Certainly anybody who thinks this is a war the U.S. can wage for a decade or more, as he talks about, as a without tens of thousands of boots on the ground is either crazy or and by saying so, Obama's lying to the American people. I mean, even his latest formulation, the latest formulation he's given as they keep wangling over what this congressional authorization will say, the latest formulation from the White House says only that they'll seek to prevent, and I quote, enduring offensive ground combat operations. Well, what the hell does enduring mean? We already know what it meant in the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq.
Jim, what role has the U.S. and its allies played in the more recent advances of ISIS after the bombing of Syria?
Yeah, well, the bombing of Syria, of course, Heidi, is a big part of that. And by backing the kinds of despotic leaders that we've backed in the past, of course, it plays into the hands. It allows a group like ISIS to insert itself. For example, you mentioned Syria. You know, as we try to get rid of Assad, and we claim initially that there are genuine, revolutionary Syrians who want a democracy and so forth. That's clearly, if it ever was the case, not the case now. And in fact, the people that are having the most success fighting Syrian government and the Assad government now is ISIS. And they are, quote-unquote, become de facto our allies in trying to get rid of Assad. And whatever we do to try to get rid of Assad is simply, therefore, strengthening ISIS on the ground again. And, of course, Saudi Arabia and Kuwait and others have funded not just ISIS, but have funded al-Qaeda, and for years. Our so-called allies that now somewhat reluctantly will drop a bomb or two on somebody, were part of the creating the conditions that ISIS arose in the first place. And as I say, in the case of Syria, are strengthening ISIS and leaving the U.S. really in a particularly ridiculous position in its ill-thought-of and ill-advised war in Syria.
The American people have been shown acts by ISIS that are truly appalling, beheading people, damaging ancient monuments, destroying artworks and museums. I mean, what do you say as a spokesperson for the peace movement about why they shouldn't be stopped?
Yeah, I would hope, as much as anyone alive on this earth today that isn't a part of that barbaric group of folks, that they would be stopped. The question is not, should they be stopped? The question is, what will be effective in stopping them? And is there anything the U.S. can do, in fact, that would be effective in stopping them? And my contention, and it's not simply my contention, the contention of the organized peace movement, we'll talk about that, I guess, a little later. There's great unity for a change in the anti-war movement. They've got unified actions planned for later this month in Washington, D.C. And what is clear to all of us is that by the United States doing what it is doing, it is in fact strengthening ISIS. Every time a drone falls down and kills a few civilians and damages a village as well as whatever target they may or may not have hit, there's some more. That's a recruitment poster for ISIS, obviously. The fact that the U.S. has for so long and still does have military bases in all these countries, that's an affront. That's a recruitment poster, if you will, for ISIS. When Obama says, we're not at war with Islam. We're not at war with the Muslim world. We're just at war with these terrorists. It's incredulous to me that he would say such a thing. I mean, for the last 20 years, by UN estimates, the U.S. and its allies, Western allies, have killed upwards of 3 million Muslims. I mean, I don't know how in one breath, when you're standing there as president of the United States of a country that has participated in the killing of 2.5 to 3 million Muslims and are still doing so on a daily basis, how you can say we're not at war with Islam? And because we are at war with it, it plays into the hands of the barbarians who have taken the lead in that fight against us. It's seen as heroic by young people who haven't seen anything else beat us. All they've seen is the destruction of their countries and their way of life at our hands. And so the anti-war movement is going to be tough for the anti-war movement because, yes, the propaganda machine, the mainstream media in this country has done its job of pandering by showing despicable pictures. You know, what we never seem to see, because they're not shown. Saudi Arabia, our staunchest ally, if you will, in the region, executes somewhere between 20, depending on what month you're talking about, 20 to 25, by beheading, executes 20 to 25 people in their own country every month. I mean, Saudi Arabia is cut off the heads of far more people than ISIS in its wildest dreams has yet accomplished. Our hands are dirty from the deaths of the Saudi government when it executes people for crimes that nobody else would consider a crime, and in the barbaric way of cutting off your head. But American people are understandably disgusted with what ISIS is doing. They should be disgusted with what ISIS is doing. The full story has to be told, and it hasn't been yet, and it's always difficult in this country. One of the things that's going to take place in March, there's going to be actions in D.C. between March about 18th, 19th, the starting date's a little unclear, and the 21st. Cindy Sheehan, who many people remember with Camp Casey, is setting up a Camp Casey at the Capitol. All the major anti-war groups are then holding a massive teach-in on this very issue we're talking about now. Who is ISIS? Where did it come from? And would Obama's policies possibly do anything but make matters worse? And then that's going to be followed. The Answer Anti-War Coalition has been given the job of organizing a massive protest on the 21st of March at the Capitol, culminating that by almost a week of anti-war activities. But the idea that, in a sense, that the doing what we did in Iraq for so long, in Afghanistan, that doing it now again there and adding Syria and Libya to the mix is somehow going to work better this time, you know, it calls to mind Einstein's old quote about, you know, the scientist who keeps doing the same thing over and over expecting a different result is either insane or stupid.
Jim, we want to get your reaction to Netanyahu's recent speech to the U.S. Congress and how this informs what we've been talking about.
Yes, yes. Well, and it does inform it. I mean, you could take a lot of his lines, but just take his line that Iran is our biggest enemy, not ISIS. He compared Iran and ISIS in this jingoistic way. It's hard to know what to say to that. It's so factually untrue. It's first of all, you have to start from the assumption that a nuclear power like Israel, getting all exercised about the fact that somewhere down the road, a neighboring country might have the same weapons it has. Pardon me if I can't get terribly excited about that. I don't want to see it. We shouldn't have any country in the world with nuclear weapons. But I don't know by what moral authority we tell Iran it can't have them when we've got them and Israel has them and the list goes on and on.
I just want to point out that Israel does not admit to having nuclear weapons, refuses to sign the Nuclear Nonproliferation Pact, which Iran has signed. And what Iran is developing are not nuclear weapons, but a nuclear capacity for electrical power and
amazing,
medicine.
And by the way, it never found its way into print in the Los Angeles Times. Here the documents get released showing that the Mossad had told Netanyahu, made it very clear to Netanyahu, that they were not developing nuclear bomb capabilities. That he stands right up in front of the world, and with that stupid drawing of a bomb, and it's almost ready to go off because what? Because Iran is close to having what his own Secret Service forces said is not true. I mean, in addition to everything else, he's lying about the threat, if it were a threat. And then to come to the Congress, I was thinking to myself, if some big divisive issue was going on in Israel, Knesset, can you imagine the President of the United States going over and arguing for the opposition to Netanyahu before their elected leaders? I mean, the audacity of the thing. You talk about mucking about in somebody else's business. He's entitled to have his opinion, of course, about whether or not Iran should or should not, we should be making deals with Iran, but to come to the U.S. Congress and to give that bloviating speech where he offers nothing new, he offers no alternative to what the administration is trying to do and is apparently making some progress in doing, is hailed by at least one side of the aisle is a hero for doing so. It's really quite appalling.
Jim, Michael Ratner's out of town today, but he sent an email to Michael Smith, and Michael's going to read a part of that
now. I'd like your reaction to this.
Please.
Michael watched the Netanyahu speech on March 3rd, and this is what he said about it. Did you watch this yet? One of the more disgusting, blood-curdling performances I've ever seen. Congress was worse than Netanyahu. I had to cover my eyes, my mouth, my ears. All the buttons were pressed. Our 1,000 years of oppression, genocide. Eli Wiesel was brought out. Moses was brought out about bringing our people to the promised land, and more and more. If we think for a second that this country, or at least this Congress, will ever make a difference on this issue, it's dead wrong. Change, as it always does, will come from the militants on the ground, BDS and so on. What is comparable? Rome supporting some military outpost in the middle of England or France or wherever? The barbarians, read the natives peoples, want their freedom. The entire congressional chamber just seemed soaked in blood to me. That was Michael's reaction to Netanyahu.
Well, I do not disagree with a word of it. I guess I was trying to be...
You were trying to be restrained, Jim?
I was trying to be a little restrained, which I am not normally. And I thank Michael Ratner for expressing my feelings much better than I did just a few minutes ago. He couldn't be more right. I would argue, and you know, even in Israel, people are arguing that this has actually harmed Israeli-American relations.
Well, sure.
Well, that's something that I can't get upset about, because those relations, of course, have been simply to the detriment of the Palestinian people and many other peoples of the world. We could talk about whether it was even a smart move by a desperate politician who's fearing that he's not going to get elected again. But however you look at it, it was an embarrassing moment for the Congress of the United States. There's a quote in the L.A. Times here about, and I suppose the New York Times and elsewhere, I haven't seen them yet, by Nancy Pelosi, who says, "I love Israel, but I was crying during so much of his speech because he was insulting the intelligence of the American people." And
I hope she's right.
Yeah.
And of course, she's right. Among other things, he was also doing that, you know, and offering, as Obama said, absolutely nothing new. But Israel, if you think about it, Israel has no history of engaging in diplomacy. It always finds an excuse not to negotiate with the Palestinians. It much prefers bombarding the poor people of Gaza than it does to sitting down at a table and talking about anything with anybody. So why should we be surprised that the leader of such a country doesn't think the United States should talk to Iran about its nuclear program? And in saying that, I frankly don't think we have a right to talk to Iran about its nuclear program.
Yeah, and I don't think that
before.
Netanyahu has no right invoking his distorted view of Jewish history to fan the flames of his paranoia. It was really a supreme irony, I thought, that he trotted out everything as Michael cataloged.
And, you know, interestingly enough, a public opinion poll before his speech here in this country showed that 63% of the American people thought it was inappropriate and wrong for him to come and make that speech.
Jim, we only have a couple of minutes remaining. If people are interested in learning more about these topics, where can they go, or about the upcoming peace events in D.C.?
Yes. Well, you can go on various left websites. The Party for Socialism and Liberation has a website that details much of this history. You can go on the answer.org website, and there they will list all the activities that this United Peace Movement, you know, Code Pink and the UNAC and the veterans groups and you name it, they've all come together around this program I'm talking about in March, the teach-in, the Camp Casey, the 21st demonstration. Answer.org would have all of that listed, would also tell you how you can help out from whatever community you may be in. Many cities around the country, Los Angeles and elsewhere, are going to be doing things to mirror what happens, at least on the 21st of March in Washington, D.C. And I, knowing your listening audience, I would hope they would go do that, because we haven't talked about this, but there is almost a world war going on now. It's so far limited to the Middle East, but if you look at all of what's going on in the Middle East, it's hard not to be alarmed about what this portends for the future. And if the United States and its Western allies do what Obama and many in Congress of both parties want to do, it's going to make a terrible situation horrific. And so the American people had better start speaking up about it, understanding what's really at stake, and saying no to their government and no new expanded war in the Middle East.
Sobering words, Jim, and it's been a pleasure to chat with you today. We wish you all the best and hope to have you on soon again.
Well, I love it. It's always a pleasure to be with you folks, and I thank you for the opportunity.
Thanks, Jim.
Thanks, Jim.
Take it easy.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
As president of the Burkina Faso, one of Africa's poorest countries, Thomas Sankara is often referred to as the African Che Guevara. In 1987, he was assassinated during a military coup that took down his four-year-old progressive government. Despite that, Sankara's economic and social policies left an important mark not only on his country, but across the entire nation of Africa. Sankara was a Marxist and openly sought independence from France at the same time that he was building a Pan-African unity. He remains an inspiration to young people throughout that nation for his integrity, idealism, and dedication to independence and self-determination. In his recently published book, Thomas Sankara, an African Revolutionary, Ernest Harsh tells the story of Sankara's life and struggles. This is the first English-language book to report on this late leader, his leadership, and the inspiration he's created among young people throughout Africa. Professor Harsh is a research scholar at the Institute of African Studies at Columbia University. He worked on African issues at the United Nations for more than 20 years and is the author of South Africa, White Rule, Black Revolt. Ernest, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Now, tell us who Thomas Sankara was, and why should our listeners care about him?
Well, he was the president of the West African country of Burkina Faso from 1983 to 1987, a very short period of time. He was a revolutionary. Everybody acknowledged that at the time, especially the French, who greatly disliked him. The U.S. wasn't too happy with him. He wanted to stop in Atlanta to meet with Andrew Young during his visit to the U.N. General Assembly. They didn't allow him to make that stop, so he spoke in Harlem instead. And it's a small West African country. Not even that many experts on Africa know much about it.
When he took over, what was it called?
It was called Upper Volta.
And he changed the name?
In the year after they took power, they changed the name. And I'll get into a little bit of that. So he was in power for only about 4 years. He was overthrown in the military coup by the second most important person in the regime, who was also head of the military, Blaise Compaoré, who was then in power for 27 years until he was overthrown last October.
Why should people care about him?
Okay, it's not a well-known country. He wasn't well-known at all. But I think for people who are interested in progressive change, it's always useful, and, you know, the people are interested in seeing how others elsewhere in the world are fighting against oppression, are fighting for their rights, and occasionally are actually able to make some change. And it's also useful to learn about what kind of leadership can help people do that. And that's where his contribution was, at the leadership level. He wasn't a grassroots activist. He came out of the military. He was a captain. But he got radicalized in the military, and because of the context of his country, which was extremely poor and underdeveloped and backward and subservient to the French, who had been their former colonial power, and very corrupt, both military and civilian politicians over the decades. And people thought like him, there were many others, wanted to break out of that old system. So they were actually able to lead a revolutionary struggle and come into power, partly because they had some sectors of the military with them, but they also had a broad base of civilian support, including revolutionary civilian organizations. So they were able to do that.
You know, one of the things that in your book that I read and we're speaking with, Ernest Harsh wrote an important book, Thomas Sankara, an African Revolutionary, that I noticed was about colonialism and neocolonialism. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the African leadership that took over after the end of colonialism became neocolonialists. And he had strong words about this, as you said in your book.
This is interesting, and sort of he's widely recognized outside of Burkina in Africa as one of the heroes of a Pan-Africanist hero. But most of the others, like Patrice Lumumba, Amilcar Cabral, you know, they got their chops in fighting against colonialism. He's representing a newer generation where that initial idealism about independence will bring all sorts of changes, you know, has it begun to wear off and people were disillusioned. He's speaking to the ills of formerly independent countries that are still subservient to their colonial masters, still haven't found any way to break out of the, you know, trap of underdevelopment and external economic domination. So he's speaking to a different generation, which still resonates today. That is young people who are, you know, fed up with the way things are. They're fed up with the corruption of their leaders, whether they're elected or not elected. They're fed up with elites that are more inclined to the former colonial powers and other Western powers than they are to their own citizens. So whatever one's ideology, a lot of young people are attracted to them. I mean, you go through, travel through West Africa, you see Sankara T-shirts. You turn on the radio, there's reggae and rap artists who are quoting Sankara in their songs, and their videos are out there. So, you know, it's very popular because it resonates with the issues today.
Yeah, some people call him the Che Guevara of Africa.
That's, I mean, I did a slideshow a couple of days ago. I had slide after slide of people with separately T-shirts of Che and Sankara. Some T-shirts, I had both of them on there at demonstrations with portraits of Che and of Sankara. You know, it's that image of somebody who gave their lives struggling, you know, for freedom, for liberation, whatever the odds. And the odds in Burkina were very hard. They were very hard.
Well, I'm holding in my hand, and you can almost hold this book in your palm. It's not a pamphlet, but it's a short book, which makes it accessible, I think, and has a beautiful cover with a drawing of Thomas Sankara. And then it has a title, of course, Thomas Sankara, an African Revolutionary by Ernest Harsh. And it's part of the Ohio Short Histories of Africa series. This book was published by the Ohio University Press, of all presses. This is a very much needed book. We, of course, knew about Thomas Sankara, and there's nothing like this in English. This is fills a real need. So congratulations, Ernest, for coming out with your book. Tell us what it was like when you met him.
Well, I mean, the first time I met him was in New York at the Burkinabe mission to the UN. He had come in to address the General Assembly and to speak up at Harlem. There was a small group of us journalists who met with him. And, you know, I mean, I've talked to and interviewed heads of state before. Not so often military officers, but, you know, I mean, the guy, he was direct. I mean, he listened to what you had to say, and he thought about it. And I've never met anybody who was so quick. I mean, he was witty. I mean, you lose it. He loved making puns, usually in French, so they don't translate well. But he would coin words and turn things around. You know, there'd be hostile questions, and he just knew how to turn it around. And he was direct. He was, you know, he just related to you. So the other times I met him in Burkina, Sometimes, first time was a long interview. The other times he didn't want to be interviewed. He just wanted to talk about politics. You know, how was it that the Solidarity Movement in the U.S. sent so many young Americans to Nicaragua, with the pro-Sandinista brigades? Was there some way that we could tap into the African-American community and get some of them to go to Burkina or other African countries to build the solidarity across the diaspora? Or did he talk about the struggle in Chad because they were involved in some mediation stuff? Or we just talk about politics more generally? He just wanted to talk. He loved it. He'd listen.
What were his views on women?
Okay, this was the mid-1980s. There were some advanced things in the developed countries, in the U.S. and Europe. But in Africa at the time, hardly anybody spoke about the issue of women. The usual response was, this is a Western feminist agenda. This isn't African because of African traditions. Well, he broke through all that. He was an early precursor. Up to that time, nobody had promoted or named so many women to cabinet positions. At the high point, there were 5 women in his cabinet of about 25, 26, about a fifth of them at least. One of them now is the current Minister of Justice, Josefine Wadrogo. So, that experience helped train some. At the local level, that's elite women. They tried to organize women into the committees for the defense of the revolution, and they had quota systems. So at least 2 women had to be in the leadership of the 7-member CDR bureaus. They changed the family code, and this is quite an archaic, backward system in Burkina.
One second, just for our listeners, CDRs are Committees of Defense of the Revolution.
Committees for the Defense of the Revolution.
Which, of course, reminds you very much of Cuba, which had CDRs from the 60s.
Still do.
Yeah. And Cuba was a little bit of a model to them, but also they tried to tackle some of the restrictions on women at the local level. It's hard. They made a small dent in it. They fought against female genital mutilation. Just even the right to divorce by mutual consent, not just the husband's decision or the patriarch's decision, and to provide economic opportunities for women. They helped form cooperatives of women who did fabrics and developed this whole line of clothing called Faso Danfani, which was traditional African dress. So it was promoting African pride, but it was done by homespun cotton because Burkina grew a lot of cotton. And it was women's cooperatives who did these, and by requiring civil servants to wear them at special occasions, there was a built-in market. Everybody had to go out and buy one of these Faso Danfani outfits. They're now a source of pride. The new prime minister, he shed his military uniform, and he's now out there in public wearing Faso Danfani. Which gets, it's a good segue to talk about the nation-building aspects. You mentioned earlier it was called Upper Volta, which was a colonial name. They wanted something African. And Burkina Faso, the words, are from 2 local African languages. It basically means the land of the upright or the uncorruptible people. It can be translated different ways. And then the people are known as Burkinabé, and the Bé comes from a 3rd African language in the country. So it's kind of a pan-territorial thing, and it's clearly African. And whatever anybody thought of Sankara, and even including right-wing conservatives in the country, nobody calls themselves Voltaics. Nobody wants to go back to that. They're Burkinabé. They like it, and people who travel abroad, they put down their Burkinabé passport, and it's a source of pride. And others react, you're from Burkina Faso. Whatever else you think about the politics, and it sort of helped knit the country together in a way that hadn't been before. So, that's, if you're a revolutionary, you don't have a coherent nation, that's not a bad starting point.
Ernest Harsh, talk to us about Thomas Sankara's foreign policy.
Well, clearly, he demonstrated that before he became president, because he was briefly a prime minister in a coalition government. His first trip was to Libya. So he got a big welcome there and invited Gaddafi back. So people originally said, he was a pawn of Gaddafi. He made that clear early on because Gaddafi said, look, we have this green book, maybe you should check it out. And he said, look, I quoted in the book, we're not political virgins. Thank you. But we have our own experience. And then he went to the Non-Aligned Summit in New Delhi and gave this very fiery speech, basically solidarizing with the Cuban Revolution, with the Nicaraguans, with the Western Saharans, with the New Caledonians then, or the Kanak struggle against France. It was very, very hot, and he clearly aligned himself with the anti-imperialist, pro-third world, pro-development wing within the Non-Aligned movement. The French didn't like that, so they told some of their people locally, okay, let's get rid of this guy. They had an internal coup. He was arrested in prison for a while, and then, but they couldn't sustain that. It was too popular. There was a reaction against it demanding his freedom, and the civilian supporters organized, and eventually then they came to power and, you know, freed him, and he became president.
Kind of a parallel with what happened with Hugo Chavez.
A little bit like that, yeah, but a much shorter period of time. There wasn't, he didn't have a long period in prison. They just, because the people who carried out the pro-French coup just didn't have the support to sustain it.
This was in 1983.
83, yeah. That a very quick series of events in 1983 led to the revolution. And then when he was president, he just demonstrated the same thing. I mean, he was the first African head of state to visit the liberated areas in Western Sahara with Polisario. He played a key role within the Organization of African Union then in getting the Saharan Republic recognized as a member of the OAU. So that prompted Morocco's withdrawal from the organization. That's still the case. He went to Cuba a number of times. When he came to the U.S., you know, he would usually pass through Cuba, come to the U.S., go back through Cuba. Once he went to Cuba, then did a trip to Nicaragua, side trip for the, it was an anniversary of the Sandinista Liberation Front. And he spoke on behalf of all the foreign delegations to a crowd of several hundred thousand in Managua.
You remember the year? Was it, would have been July, because that was the anniversary of the revolution, not the Sandinista.
Then I'm thinking 85 or 86. Yeah, I can't remember exactly.
The likelihood I...
Were you there, Michael?
Oh, very good possibility. I went to every one of them, so I was probably there, but do I remember anything?
Well, this wasn't the anniversary of the revolution, but of the founding of the Sandinista Liberation.
So I wasn't there. Anyway.
Needless to say, you could expect France, the U.S., to earmark this guy as somebody who probably should be eliminated. Fortunately for them, they found forces within the country, within the leadership itself, who were uncomfortable with the direction things were taking. Some of them probably were corrupt inclined, and they didn't like the anti-corruption campaigns. And Campoore, who was the head of the military, he was the Minister of Defense, married a daughter of Houphouët Boigny, the president of Côte d'Ivoire next door. It was very pro-French. So there was that direct line. And, you know, there were differences over how open or narrow to organize the political process in Burkina Faso. Sankara was more open-minded. He wanted a broader, inclusive kind of political organization. The other ones were small, little, very narrow, student-based, university-based, leftist groups who admired Enver Hoxha of Albania, Joseph Stalin, and they were more comfortable with sort of top-down, repressive kinds of approach. So there were differences, and, you know, the Campoore played into that and carried out the coup.
I want to talk a little bit more about the coup, but before we do, we talked about foreign policy. Tell us about domestically in those 4 years. What kinds of things he was doing, what he was shifting, why some people opposed it.
Okay. Well, in Africa, he's most known for the foreign policy stuff. In Burkina, he's most known for the domestic stuff. I mean, they like that foreign policy stance, too, but especially on the domestic front. I already mentioned the nation building. We talked about what he did on women. He tried to refashion the entire state apparatus. I mean, they put hundreds of officials on trial for corruption. And these were public trials, the public could attend, so they educated people about how the old regimes and old officials would misuse their power. He then extended in the last year or so of his life to current office holders, you know, trying to keep that from happening to the current leadership. They totally restructured the state. They ensured that, well, look, this is a very rural country. Only a tiny fraction of the population lived in the cities. And insofar as any public investments went to development, they went to those few cities. He reversed that. He and his comrades, I should say, reversed that. They whatever they had, and they didn't have a lot, very poor country, they emphasized investments in the rural areas, health clinics, schools. Every village, there were about 7,000, they established a primary health care center. I don't know how many schools they built, or they didn't build necessarily the government, but they encouraged people, local people, to gather the materials and build, and then the authorities would provide expert opinion. Water was a key thing. I mean, so they built irrigation canals, water reservoirs. Very poor country, so revolutionary steps in such a poor country can often be very basic. And it demonstrated to people on the ground that this was a government different from those before. There's a lot of cynicism about politicians. And, you know, in rural areas, I talked to people. And, well, you know, they weren't quite sure about these guys from Ouagadougou, but, you know, they seemed to be doing something more than had ever been done before. On economic development, it was emphasizing domestic resources and mobilization and markets. They were trying gradually to break free of a dependence on just exporting cotton to earn money. They took steps against the local merchant class who would engage in speculation. There wasn't really any industrial manufacturing sector to talk about, so, I mean, they didn't go through wholesale nationalizations, except a lot of the state enterprises had been run privately pretty much and corruptly, so they cleaned those up. Also, he was also a precursor not just on the issue of women, but of sustainable development. Planting trees, making sure that the environment was taken into account. And this was a couple years before the UN's Earth Summit in Rio. And in Africa at the time, again, environmental issues were seen somehow as a Western plot to deny Africa industrialization. But he saw that, no, I mean, these are poor countries, depend on the environment. I mean, agriculture depends on rainfall, so you use whatever water you can, you harvest it. So there was the sustainability aspect. And inequality throughout, not that there were grave differences in people's living standards, almost everybody was fairly poor except for the small elites. Everything was sort of equity. You know, the top government officials, they get rid of their luxury cars. They, you know, their salaries would get slashed. They get rid of their housing bonuses. And then what they had got invested into sectors of the economy and social services that were important for poor people.
Ernest, on the day that Sankara was killed, October 15, 1987, assassinated, you were actually in Burkina Faso, right?
I was. I wasn't in the capital. I was in the small village of Pibo Ore.
Tell us about that.
Well, the village, I mean, we were there. There was a farmers' rally, and we reviewed some of the water reservoir clinics and other things that had been built by villagers. And there was a little bit of a rally, you know, and some people with Sankara T-shirts there. We didn't know what was going on at the Capitol at the time. The rally finished, and at a certain point on the radio, suddenly started to hear military music. I mean, this is typical for coups. You start hearing military music, uh-oh. And people started getting concerned. No news came out, except later in the evening there was an announcement that Sankara's autocratic regime had been overthrown and a new popular front was in power, headed by Blaise Compaoré. We didn't even know Sankara had been killed yet. Got back to Ouagadougou the next day and found out.
Can you explain how he was assassinated?
He was in a meeting with about 12 of his aides and bodyguards. And it was around somewhere between 4 and 5 on the afternoon of the 15th. And a units we later learned were under the command of officers loyal to Compaoré. Compaoré always denied he gave orders, but things didn't happen within the military without orders from higher up. They burst in and basically just immediately started shooting. Once it started, a couple of his guards were killed outside. He thought, okay, they're here for me. So he went outside to meet them, thinking that maybe his other aides and comrades would be spared. They shot him. There wasn't even much of an exchange. He was killed. They went into the room and mowed down everybody else. There was only one survivor. He later gave an account of that.
How old was he at the time?
He was 37. He was only 33 when he became president. So, you know, this was a youthful leadership.
And who became president after him?
Blaise Compaoré.
And he remained president until?
Until October of last year.
Now, in that period, which is what, almost how many
27
years?
27 years.
27 years. Even that government, Compaoré, had to begin to recognize something positive about Sankara, at least something, because they originally had him in sort of an unmarked grave or some grave outside, you said in the book, with his dozen people who were killed. And then slowly they had to do something more for Sankara, even within that government. Is that right?
Well, that actually began from the very beginning, because they tried to organize support marches for the new government. They failed because people would come out and start stoning them, especially students. I went to the cemetery where the grave was, and hundreds of people went. They were mourning. They weren't cheering the new government, obviously, and they were opposing any effort by the new government to do support demonstrations. They'd leave flowers at the gravesite, messages, you know, Mama Sankara, we will avenge you, you know, we are all Sankara, things like that. So it was very unpopular government initially, and they had to retract or at least step back from their very severe invective against Sankara. And they actually claimed to be continuing the revolution. They called it a rectification. After a few years, they just dropped even the revolutionary rhetoric. They went, because of pressure from France, they organized multi-party elections, which Compaoré's people organized a dominant party, which controlled every election since then. Continued repression. It wasn't until about 2000 or so, well, actually by the 1990s, political groups who called themselves Sankarist, that is, followers of Sankara, could begin to organize, run elections, and they got people elected. So there was a residual base of support for Sankara. Of course, anybody who was critical of the Compaoré regime, that would be a natural pole to drift toward.
You know, on reflection, in the two decades before Sankara was executed, we lost Malcolm X and Martin Luther King and Che, who were all about the same age. And then to have this happen again 20 years later, the only exception I can think of is that the bodyguards around Castro were effective enough to ward off some 620 assassination attempts. But here, unfortunately, it didn't happen. Anyway, you've brought us up to date and told us a happy ending to this story, Ernest, and we're grateful.
We've been speaking with Ernest Harsh, author of a really wonderful short book, Thomas Sankara, an African Revolutionary. Recommend it to everybody. It's a history most of you probably are not familiar with. Thank you, Ernest.
You're welcome.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.